You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hello, everyone. This is MLB.com Extras, American League Central Edition. I'm Anthony Kasterman, and as we do each week, we're going to use the next hour or so to check in on every Central team for your educational fulfillment and listening pleasure. The big news in the Central since we last spoke was the Indians trade of Nick Swisher and Michael Bourne. Jordan Bastion will join us to break that down. We'll also talk about Al Avila's first day as GM of the Tigers with Jason Beck. We'll hear from Jeffrey Flanagan on the Royals, Scott Merkin on the White Sox, and Corey Provis will fill in for Rhett Bollinger with some Twins talk. Thanks for tuning in. Let's get to it. Thanks for tuning in. The Royals are 14-10 since the break and just kind of plodding along, waiting for their coronation, frankly, in the AL Central. They're just running away with that division. We're going to bring in Jeffrey Flanagan to talk about what's going on with the Royals this past week and kind of looking ahead. Jeffrey, I guess the big news is the batting order change Ned Yost made with Ben Zobrist now aboard. And he goes to the number two spot. Mike Moustakas, of course, has been in the number two spot all year and really lasted at number two a lot longer than anybody could have anticipated when the move was first made. But with Moose now at six and Zobrist at two, what's sort of behind that move?
Yeah, I think Ned said that when they got Zobrist, that even though he put him in the sixth spot originally, he really viewed him as a number two hitter, likes to have a switch hitter up there, a guy who's got a pretty good on-base percentage. And Moose, you know, you wonder a little bit if he's upsetting the apple cart here a little bit, because Moose's career turned around, coincidentally, when he went into the number two spot. So it might be kind of a gamble, but you know, that's just the way. And Ned's not a guy who's really big on tinkering with the order, but I think he's pretty well set right now on having Zobrist hit second, although there was a game in there after he made the decision that Moose batted second anyway because Zobrist got a day off. But I think going forward, you're gonna probably see him in there, and he loves it. Like I said, he likes the fact that you have a switch hitter in the number two spot, another one in the number five spot, so it gives him a lot of versatility in the lineup.
They have to be pleased with the power Zobrist has brought to the table here early on, a few homers already in his first handful of games with his club. And Zobrist, he had a slow start to the season with a knee issue and then coming back from that pretty quickly. But it seems like he's really settled into his season at this point.
Yeah, and he got really a big base hit yesterday that put them up 4-3. A 0-2 pitch, he kind of stayed with it. And those are the type of at bats that Ned and Dayton just love seeing from a veteran like that. And early on in Toronto, of course, you know, he got a homer from both sides of the plate in the same game. So he's got that kind of pop. But he just gives him a nice veteran plate appearance every time he gets up there. And that's really a key for Ned. And like I said, going forward, having that versatility in the lineup is just going to be huge.
How about the way Chris Medlin stepped up Sunday? 3 2/3 hitless, scoreless innings. We've talked so much about it, just seems like everything Dayton Moore touched this winter. I guess with the exception of Alex Rios, and we'll get into him in a minute, but you know, everything he touched turned to gold. And here's Medlin, 2-year contract, you know, hoping for a bounce back off of the surgery. And you know, I don't know where he fits into the big picture here as far as October is concerned, but boy, that was a really really encouraging display there.
Yeah, I mean, how much depth can you really have? I mean, and you just keep, you know, reaching in the cookie jar and pulling out somebody else. And the really impressive thing about Medlin yesterday is he hadn't pitched. That was only his third appearance in 16 days, so you would think he'd be rusty, and he was absolutely not rusty. I mean, he came in and retired every hitter but one, and the one batter that reached with a walk, he picked off. So just a phenomenal effort, and really the reason they came back to win yesterday was because of him. And going forward, I mean, they stretched him out to a little over 50 pitches yesterday. He's been up to 90 pitches in his rehab. His last rehab start at Northwest Arkansas was, I think, 92 pitches. So, you know, a lot of fans are already clamoring for him to jump into that number five spot to replace Guthrie. And that may happen down the road. You never know. But right now, he hasn't been stretched out beyond 50 since he's been a reliever here. So you might see a little bit more of that. But it's just been hard for Ned to get innings for these guys because he's already got his power five in the bullpen. Generally speaking, they're pitchers don't, you know, have bad outings and only go 2 or 3 innings. So he hasn't had to use Medlin or Chris Young But he's trying desperately to find spots where he can keep those guys sharp, and that's been the biggest challenge for him so far. He's just got so many good arms down there, and we saw another one yesterday with Medlin. So definitely next year he's going to be a factor in spring training for the rotation. He may or may not, depending on how Guthrie does down the stretch here, he may be a candidate for the fifth spot here if they get him stretched out.
Pleased to be joined by this week by Corey Provis. He's filling in for Rhett Bollinger, who's off this week. And Corey, the Twins had a really rough road trip. They dropped 7 of their last 8 overall, dropped 16 of their last 22 overall, and they're under 500 for the first time since May 2nd. So I guess just in the context of, you know, some people saw this club as maybe ahead of schedule as far as contention is concerned, but, you know, obviously those are competitive men in that clubhouse. It's been a very difficult stretch. So just what's your read on, you know, the mindset and the makeup of this club right now?
Well, Anthony, the starting pitching had, and maybe to a surprise, had been kind of the anchor with this team all season long. And then this last week, the rotation just kind of fell apart. And from top to bottom, all the starters struggled mightily. The collective ERA on the last road trip was around 15 or 16. So the Twins, in essence, are really lucky to win one game on the road trip, considering how poor the starting pitching was. So that of late was problematic. But before that, even since the All-Star break, the offense had been sputtering. We saw some signs of the offense kind of turning around a little bit, but not enough to sustain any kind of winning trend. But a lot of things that went well for this team, specifically in the month of May, and a lot of this was set up by one great month, and that was in May when they went 20-7. You know, they've been under 500 since June 1, if you take out May. And I think at times the offense has been inconsistent, but at least of late, the starting pitching has been dreadful.
I want to get your take on Phil Hughes this season. Obviously, he was such a huge key for them last year, a great signing. They extend them going into this year. And, you know, he's had some really encouraging moments, but he's also been burned by the long ball quite a bit. Major League High, 28 home runs. He says he's healthy. For the record, but obviously he's pitched. He's had some rough goes here lately. What's your read on Hughes this season, and what direction he's headed?
I mean, last year he got by with just a few pitches. It wasn't like he invented this new pitch and led to a 16 win and 16 walk season in 2014. But his four seam, his cutter, and his breaking ball, and to an extent a sinker, he was throwing those pitches enough, and they were working well. You know, come 2015, April and May, I think what Phil learned is that what worked for him last year was not working this year. And so then when he got to late May, early June, he started throwing more curveballs, but more changeups. And so he's tried to mix it up a bit more than he did last year, and he's needed to. But the one thing, Anthony, that nobody can really pinpoint is why Hughes' velocity is down. He's been around 89, 90, maybe 91. We're not talking about a guy that throws 97, but, 90 right. to 93, that's a pretty big difference. And he's just, the velocity has just not been there all year long. And nobody can really pinpoint as to why. Phil is frustrated by it. I know Neil Allen, the pitching coach, is frustrated by it, as are many more. But the lack of velocity, and maybe it's because the cutter and the four-seam have looked pretty identical with velocity, and they just haven't been as effective. And the home run ball has really hurt him, and that's been an issue from day one. He gave up 16 last year. He has blown by that and then some here, and still about 2 months left in the season.
You know, with the pitching struggling as it is, Corey, Jose Berrios has to be an intriguing option, at least from a number standpoint. 1.59 ERA over his last 5 starts on a real roll at AAA, but at the same time, that would be a pretty aggressive move. Do you have any sense of the Twins potentially turning to him down the stretch, or is that something that's more of a back burner issue?
Well, I think he's definitely in their plans. Now, what's going to be interesting to watch this week, Anthony, is come Saturday. The Twins need a fifth starter for their game this Saturday at home against Cleveland. And, you know, I think the plan right now is to make that kind of a bullpen day, because Tommy Malone can't come off the DL until August 16th. And everybody believes you won't need a rehab start, that Tommy can make that first start when eligible to come off the DL. But that's a day before the Twins need that fifth starter. I think right now the plan is a bullpen day. But in this upcoming Texas series, if the lack of starting pitching continues and they have to go down and get somebody, it's hard to ignore what Barrios is doing right now. His last start came a few days back, and he had 7 scoreless innings. He struck out 9, allowed just 5 hits. He's got the makeup to be a frontline starter, and that's what this rotation really doesn't have. They've got some veterans. They've got some guys who've been around a while, but they don't have a frontline true 1 or 2. And I'm not saying Barrios is that right now, but because he's such an athlete, because he has such a good arsenal of pitches to play with, I think it is fair to say that he projects to be a frontline guy. I'm not saying a number one, but certainly a number two. But if it doesn't work out this weekend with the fifth starter, I would not be shocked if Barrios makes a start or two in September.
I am joined by Jason Beck, and it's been a whirlwind couple weeks in the Tigers' world. Of course, the biggest change is Al Avila taking over as general manager for Dave Dombrowski. That's important. You notice how I pronounce that, Beck? Avila. His son is Avila.
That was a big step that they made here, was to make that more consistent so that Al and Alex both have the same pronunciation.
So is Alex going by Avila now, or is he Avila still? Are they both Avila now?
They're both Avila now, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I think the son should have deferred to the father on that one, but that's just me. Anyway,
given that the Suns heading into free agency, yeah, you would think it would have gone that way, but no.
Interesting. Well, it's Al Avila's. He's got his first few days in office, and there's continuity in the front office with David Chad promoted to assistant GM, and just in general, I think there was some question, whether Dombrowski's lieutenants would be leaving along with him, or what would be the case, and maybe there are still changes that are coming down the road there, but what's your feel for that as far as the makeup of the front office going forward?
I think it pretty much keeps the inner circle intact. Talking with Dave Dombrowski last week, he made it sound like this is kind of what he expected, that he didn't want it to be a situation where there was going to be a camp of Al people and a camp of Dave people, and kind of a house divided until Dave decided his next step. I think he anticipated that a lot of the group would be staying together just because, despite the move on him, that, it's a group that's worked together well. And it's a group that gets along and kind of knows each other's opinions and knows the preferences. And I think when you look around baseball, it's a rarity, even after this change, it's a rarity to see a front office with this many core people sticking together for this long. And the fact that they were able to keep it together after a change at the top speaks volumes about how well this group has worked. I think David Chad's, a guy on the rise. I think he made his name in the scouting circles, and now you've seen him branch out bit by bit into player development and now player evaluation. And this is going to be a huge step for him. I think it's well earned. And I think John Westhoff getting the title of assistant GM, it's going to be interesting to see how that works out, because he's basically been the chief negotiator for them in terms of arbitration and with a lot of free agent signings. So this kind of adds a title to his already long list of responsibilities. And I think what's already been noted too is Sam Menzin, just a few years out of college, gets another notch up to director of baseball operations, a title that Mike Smith occupied up until a few weeks ago. And, a lot of people see him as a rising star. He's kind of the, advanced analytics. I guess that's kind of redundant, but he's kind of the analytical end of the Tigers front office. And, he's made a lot of impact in just a few short years. And I think, this speaks well of his future here. And, I think it speaks a lot about what way this front office might be trending under under the new regime.
Well, last time we spoke, Beck, on our last podcast, the news had just come down about Dombrowski, and I'm just curious, with some more time to digest it, how is this move being received in the clubhouse, particularly among the core guys, the guys who are going to be around a while? And I know from the outside there's a lot of question, does this affect the way the Tigers go about free agency? Are they going to cut back on spending in any way? And all those, big looming questions. But just in general, how's it being received in that room?
I think the clubhouse got hit by a few blows here. It was still a clubhouse that was reeling a bit, maybe getting back on its feet from the trades of the previous week. And then to have that happen, I think, was huge. I think a lot of guys were caught off guard by it. These are guys who, I think as Justin Verlander said, Dave Dombrowski was the only general manager. A lot of these guys who came up through the organization knew. The fact that that it was an internal move and that his successor was, promoted from within, I think did a lot for his stability here. And I think it made a lot of guys feel very comfortable. Al Avila was very involved in a lot of free agent signings and really involved in a lot of moves, free agency, minor league signings, everything. He had a big hand in day-to-day duties. And he had a big hand in bringing a lot of guys over here. So having that familiar face up top, I think, made it about as smooth as it could be. I think a lot of guys were hardened by at least the words from Al that they still saw a chance to win this year. And I think those were key turns. When you look back at the move, I think the fact that he kept emphasizing that we still think there's a chance to win this season, I think said a lot about where ownership was what ownership was feeling and where they were looking at this season in the context of the big picture. It was a shakeup. And talking with Dave, the fact that there were no contract talks leading up to this, it basically makes it sound like a dismissal. They, pretty much. I don't think that there was a whole lot of sense that setting Dave free to pursue other opportunities. It doesn't sound like he forced the issue. At least aggressively. So, maybe it was a read of the sense on the market. Maybe there's a favor to Dave to let him talk without any fear of tampering. But, it was an upheaval, to say the least.
I'm still here. Jordan Bastion is still here. Indians traded away a lot of guys the last couple of weeks, a lot of big moves. And then the offense, all of a sudden, figured out how to score some runs, JB. The offense goes crazy in the wake of the Swisher and Bourne trades, and, of course, the Murphy trade and the Brandon Moss trade that preceded it. Who are these guys? What got into these guys over the weekend?
Well, I'm sure it had absolutely nothing to do with the Minnesota Twins rotation. I think the weekend series win over the Twins kind of could go a long way for just that mindset of a team or just that overall morale where, the season hasn't gone the way they want it to go. Obviously, a lot of culture-changing trades and direction-shifting trades happened. A lot of new guys, young guys filling up that room. And, instead of kind of just mailing it in, we kind of saw some camaraderie and fight and some of the things that the Indians have been looking for all year. I thought manager Terry Francona had an interesting quote after the last game against the Twins on Sunday. He said, we seem to be more of a team this weekend than we were all year, the way we were searching. And I thought that was kind of telling for the manager to say that, after they had traded a bunch of guys who were felt to be such big parts of this team. So I think that weekend can go a long way in that room, kind of welcoming in some of the new faces, get them used to their new surroundings, and maybe breathe some life into the confidence of the hitters, knowing that, they actually can put up runs in bunches. I think that's something they've been looking to do for a long time, and, to back up a starting rotation that's been there all year. The really encouraging weekend, just in terms of the bigger picture, because the season, as we all know, has not gone the way the Indians hoped.
All right, let's delve into this Nick Swisher, Michael Bourne, Chris Johnson swap. And it's been interesting to see some of the reaction from fans and some of the reports out there. It seems to me, JB, that any evaluation of this trade from a baseball standpoint is almost meaningless because this was a financial move for both clubs, really. It's almost an even exchange of money. I believe the Indians are saving about $4 million on Swisher's deal, if you can call it a deal. And for that, they gained the flexibility immediately in 2016, and they still have some Johnson money on the books for 17. The Braves, meanwhile, are taking on two bad contracts, and then they're free and clear in 2017 when they expect to get 10. And that's the basic gist of it. I know it's a complicated deal, but that kind of breaks it down as simply as possible. But the Indians did get a piece back in Chris Johnson, and obviously they hope for bounce-back efforts from him. How does he fit into this thing moving forward in your mind?
Well, first of all, I think you hit on a great point, which is the immediate reaction was to say, whoa, they unloaded those contracts and got all this financial flexibility now. And I really think when you break it down, as you just mentioned, given the amount of money that the Indians, you know, are sending to Atlanta as part of the exchange, is that this is more about roster flexibility than it is financial flexibility of just determining that these guys were not the players that they thought they were going to be, and they shouldn't be a part of the future if this team wants to have a quick turnaround, which they still think they can with the rotation and the core group that they have in place. But you don't want to be limited with a pure DH, which I think the Indians felt Swisher had become, and you don't want to be limited with this very wealthy center fielder who's defensive metrics had declined, who isn't stealing the bases like he used to, and who all of a sudden is almost a platoon hitter, you know, because he wasn't playing much against left-handed pitching. You know, he born and looked great in the second half, and kudos to him for kind of, you know, picking it up after the All-Star break, and, you know, maybe the Braves saw something within that as well. But you're right. This was more about the roster than it was the finances in the big picture. And as far as Chris Johnson goes, I mean, if you're going to get rid of two bad contracts, you're going to have to roll the dice and maybe take one on, and that's exactly what they did. This is a guy that has played third base most of his career, but they have, you know, rookie Giovanni Urshela at third base, so, you know, he's not going to see a ton of time there. As of right now, they have Carlos Santana, Jerry Sands getting a look at first base, so he'll mix in at first a little bit as he did in his first start with the Indians. But he's also expressed a willingness to play some outfield, so if they can get a guy who can be in the lineup, hit left-handed pitching, move around a couple different positions, you know, that gives them some more versatility. And versatility is what Francona really wants with his lineup and with his players. And I think with Swisher and Bourne, that versatility had just disappeared.
I am joined by Scott Merkin to talk about the Sox. And, Merk, I don't know, the old switcheroo was pulled on this front office here. They won 7 in a row right before the deadline to get within a win of .500. Now they're going into the week 7 under .500. And you almost wonder, there's such a thing as buyer's remorse. I wonder if there's such a thing as Stan Tatter's remorse. What's your read on that situation?
First of all, is it the switcheroo or is it what's good for the goose is good? No, I'm kidding. Just doing a little Seinfeld bit there for all who remember that. You know, I think this is not really unexpected, unfortunately, for the Sox this year. They're basically a 500 to somewhat, you know, not a good piece, but slightly below 500 team, and that's how they've played all year. And, you know, I think the Sox had to, in the back of their mind, and I'm not even talking about, you know, beating up on, you know, teams that were not playing as well as them at the time, and the Indians and the Red Sox, because they played well. They had 7 of their best games of the year right in a row there, but it's just that's how they've gone this year. You know, they've never been more than one game above 500. They've never been more than 10 games under, so that's, you know, pretty much mediocre right there. And they've had instances where, you know, they swept Houston, who's still leading the AL West, and got to within 2 games of 500 and then lost 8 straight. So, you know, I mean, it's they've had other instances where they swept Oakland and then went 1-6, I believe, after that. So it's pretty much what, I mean, I think people got a little caught up because of the fact they actually hit in that winning streak, which they hadn't in past winning streaks. But the bottom line is, it's just what this team is at this point, you know, and it's disappointing for everyone in the organization. I'm sure everyone in that clubhouse even more so, that they're just not better than they are. I don't think, to answer your question, I think this buyer's remorse, or I'm sorry, Stan Tatter's remorse, we just invented a new phrase, because, you know, they asked for a high price for some margin. They didn't get it, so they didn't move him, and they felt at that time that with the parity that was in that second wild card, they still had a chance at it. You know, I guess there's one more point. There's one small silver light. Now, granted, they have a bunch of teams to jump once again, but the team that looks like they're going to have to catch, if not, you know, if Houston doesn't come back to the pack, is the Angels. And over the next 10 games, they play 7 games against the Angels. So that would be very telling, I think, what this season, you know, if that long-distance, small chance still exists, we'll know by next Thursday night, most likely.
So there you go. Just win all 7 against the Angels, and you're right in it.
I think they can probably win 6 and still be in there.
Okay. The Shark, Samardzija. Jeez, Merk. I mean, what do you make of this season? There's times we've done these podcasts talk about how good he's going, how bad he's going. I think it's a worthwhile or a reasonable question to ask if the contract pressure is on his mind at all here down the stretch, especially after, sticking with the White Sox here through the trade deadline. What are your thoughts on that? What are your thoughts on his year and how it's going to finish?
With some, you're talking about some margin, right?
Yes.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't hear it the first one. But, yeah, I mean, I don't think the contract – he's not a guy who strikes me as someone who contracts, the situation where gets him. This is something he's been pointing to for years, and he wanted a test free agency. So I don't think that's on his mind. And even if this year doesn't turn out near to what he wants, his strikeout per nine inning ratio is down. His ERA is, hovering in 4.5 area. He's had some really bad outings. I think he leads the majors as a starting pitcher with most games pitched with 7 earned runs or more. He's going to get paid in the offseason because he is still a pretty solid starting pitcher, and he's a guy who's going to, for the most part, now he has in the last couple starts, but he's going to give you 7 innings, more often than not, I think. And there's a lot to be said for those kind of pitchers these days. And, he has, even in the past when he was, putting up 200 strikeouts and knocking them down for the Cubs and a little bit for the A's last year, he still had his stretches where, Smarty didn't pitch. It wasn't overwhelming. I don't know if he's the definition. Well, he's not, at least this year for sure, the definition of a number one. He's not, in David Price's category right now. But I don't think that's been the case. For some reason, it just hasn't clicked this year. And he struggled a lot out of the stretch, too, which is an interesting point. So, it just hasn't worked. It's kind of emblematic of the whole Sox season, high expectations and not meeting them so far. Here we are in mid-August and not close to what they thought on him or the team overall.